Good evening to you all. There's so many possible Dharma themes. It can be difficult to pick one sometimes, but on the other hand, they all intertwine and they all reflect each other. So, in a certain kind of way, if one starts to, you know, start to pull at the tapestry of Dharma teachings, eventually all of it comes free. So tonight I'm going to offer a talk on upekkha. Upekkha. And this is usually translated in English as equanimity. Equanimity. And it's understood in a certain kind of way to be the capstone of Buddhist practice because it's so interlinked with wisdom. So if we were going to take a look at how this is defined, the literal translation is something like to stand in the middle of, or to be there in the middleness of experience. So this is a kind of neutrality of mind or evenness of mind that comes out of wisdom and understanding of things and training of the mind in non-reactivity, non-reactivity. So let me first talk about how the Buddha discusses this or describes this in various phases of practice. So there's a teaching that he offers called the eight worldly winds, the eight worldly winds. And he basically says here that all human beings are subject to these fluctuations of experience. He says we all experience praise and blame, gain and loss, pleasure and pain, renowned and disrepute. That there's no way that any of us can say, well, I'm only going to experience the pleasant or the upside of these dichotomies and have that happen. No matter how you live your life, no matter how careful you are in your behavior, no matter how much you try to control your inner and outer environment, one is still going to experience gain and loss, pleasure and pain, praise and blame, renowned and disrepute. So the Buddha says, if you know this is so, and the mind is trained and has developed some equanimity, one doesn't necessarily suffer or become reactive in the same kind of way that one would if you didn't fully appreciate the fact that some of this is inevitable. So, to consider the obvious of this, the Buddha says there's no one who has been born and there's no one who ever will be born who will receive just praise and never blame. So he himself got the full range all the way from people, you know, seeing him as the light of the world and people who thought, this guy, yeah. He actually would have people like repeatedly come to him and challenge him about his teachings and sometimes intentionally treat him with disrespect. There are a few assassination attempts in there, mixed in there too. Nothing new under the sun. Have you ever had the experience where, you know, you were in a situation and you did something that you thought was the best thing to do, and you're being, you know, careful and responsible, and you got blamed? Right? Maybe you put yourself in a situation even where you realized you could get blamed if it went awry, or just because you were in proximity to the situation, anybody who was kind of around there was probably going to get splashed with, you know, some kind of projectile explosion. Or did you ever have the experience of getting praised for something that you didn't actually do? Or you didn't do very well, you know? It's like, you know, somebody made a projection upon you, or maybe confused you with your identical twin or something. It's an interesting thing. Or how about the experience of getting both praise and blame for the exact same thing? You ever have that happen? I can remember once when I was a teacher trainee, the senior teacher on the retreat knew a particular story about my life because it had come up in a practice meeting with him. And so I was going to be giving a Dharma talk in front of a pretty big group. And he said, "You should tell that story. That's a really good story. You should tell that story." And I was a little like, "Well, should I tell that story? Well, he thinks I should tell that story. I'll tell that story." So I told that story, that personal story. And after I told that story, I had a yogi come up to me and break silence. And she said, "That was the most powerful story I've ever heard. That was incredible. You should teach here all the time." So the next morning at the retreat manager's meeting with the teacher group, the manager came in and said, "There was a yogi that left last night because she was so upset about that story you told. She thought it was completely inappropriate. And here's the note she left for you." And let's just say it didn't have little hearts on it. Praise and blame, you know, we're going to get them no matter how hard you try. It's just like baked into the cake. Gain and loss. Gain and loss. You ever have the experience of realizing that even in gaining, you are losing something? Like maybe in terms of developing in a certain way, made you less understandable to your family or something, or maybe the experience of, you know, having to move in order to take a job or something. And then there's the kind of losses that happen just in the course of life, right? Loss of relationships with people, you know, through death or change. Loss of physical capacities, you know, used to be able to do this, and now, God. I remember a time when I was, young, when I was really into martial arts. And I must say, I was good at it. I was a little bit of a terror at the school, but like I could remember like being able to do like jumping, spinning, back kicks and stuff, like up and down the length of a basketball court, right? And then when I got older, I had some injuries, and then at a certain point, the injuries ripened into arthritis, and then the arthritis ripened into no cartilage in the knee, and then the subjective experience was like, God, it feels really bad to walk. Can hardly walk. feels really bad. Right? So we lose capacities. We may develop other capacities, right? We might develop the capacity of having some wisdom in the mind, right? Maybe more equanimity and balance of mind to realize, well, I can't hold on to all this. This is what's happening right now. Oh, this is what's happening right now. How can I support the body now? But if the mind was stuck on the idea of, you know, you should be able to do jumping, spinning back kicks up and down the length of a basketball court for your entire lifespan, you're going to be kind of unhappy. You know, and hopefully at some point you would develop, you know, a little more elevated interest perhaps to compensate for the physical collapse. But it's inevitable, right? Gain and loss, gain and loss. Sometimes this thing comes to you out of the blue. God, this is so wonderful. You know? You win the lottery. Sometimes the lottery you win is not the good lottery you're looking to win, right? Sometimes the lottery of a particular diagnosis. Gain and loss. Pleasure and pain, these two together. Now, you've noticed from your time on the cushion, pleasure and pain. Can you relate to that? Have you had both of those? Who here has had just pleasure? Anybody who's had just pain? Right. We get both. We get the blend. It's inevitable. And this last one, that's translated as renown and disrepute. I guess this is reputational at a social level, right? Oh, now with social media, we can really get a lot of this, right? Have any of you been the unfortunate person who's been the main character in a untimely iPhone video? Where somebody's taken a video of you acting in a certain way and then uploaded it and had people recoil. Remember, there used to be this TV show called something like Jackass. Do you remember that? And this was constituted of, I think it was all men. I'll just leave it at that. But I think that's what the breakout was there. But anyway, the nature of this show, as I remember it, you know, not that I would ever watch that kind of thing personally, but I've heard about it. But like these guys would intentionally do these things that were like dangerous and just stupid, and they would like try to be doing this stuff and it would be recorded, and almost inevitably they would fail, right? And there would be like they would fall, or they would, you know, it would always be like they were acting like a jackass. But that was like out there. I mean, that will, assuming some of these folks, you know, now are in a wise relationship with someone else. You know, they probably have, like, maybe ceased this. But, like, that's still out there. Can you imagine, like, applying for a job and, you know, having your employer Google you, and there you are. Not confidence building. And then on the other hand, renown is also available to us. You know, it's an interesting thing being in this role when these talks are recorded now and they're uploaded onto Dharma Seed. And then from Dharma Seed, you know, they're taken by other online sources, and then they're promulgated out further and further. And, you know, now they're on websites, you know, in different languages, and with you can't even tell what the languages are, but there you are, and it's kind of a trip. So, you know, we have this public face now, right? Susceptible of being famous in a mini way, as well as being, you know, a jackass, and hopefully in a mini way, or having the most embarrassing experience of your life, you know, uploaded for strangers' consumption and comment. Wow. Ooh, you know, you can really get dogpiled for things that are out there in that kind of way. But the Buddha says, this is what it's like to be human. The eight worldly winds always blowing, praise and blame, gain and loss, pleasure and pain, renown and disrepute. What was that? Mark Twain, I think, said something like, lies get around the world quicker than truth can get its pants on. It's really true. But if we recognize this, we're less likely to expect it to be different, right? Because we realize that we're all, in a certain kind of way, subject to this. So you could say wisdom is knowing that this is the case and not expecting otherwise, and then not being thrown when one goes from one polarity to another. Wisdom in relationship to this. So equanimity in relationship to these polarities as they arise in our life. There's another way to think about this. The Buddha used an image which is a solid mass of rock that's not moved by the wind, just like a solid mass of rock. One is not moved by the wind. A sage is not moved by praise and blame. Right? So it still keeps going on, but we're not personally going for on a ride in relationship to it. Let's talk about images for equanimity, this quality. Did anybody ever see a movie called The Walk? So I'll describe it to you. This was, I can't remember if it was a documentary or it was a movie based on a real thing. But there was a Frenchman named Philippe Petit. How about that, Roxanne? Is that okay? You mangled the French. But that was his name. So this guy in the 1970s, I think, set out to walk from one twin tower in Manhattan to the other on a tightrope. So he was 110 stories above the ground. All right. Well, We may question how prudent that was. But he had the confidence that he could do it, and apparently it was based on something, because he did succeed in doing it. And there are these pictures of him laying down on his back on the wire, just laying there, like, and he has this balance, this pole that he holds, that he uses to help balance himself as he's walking, and now as he's lying, he's just holding it still. So for him to be able to do that, first of all, took rather remarkable focus and non-distraction, right? So could we say that was uninterrupted and continuous mindfulness? Did he have all his hindrances subdued? He did. Was his concentration good? His concentration was excellent. But he also had to have some equanimity, because he had to be like right there with it, so close to the experience. There was no room for anything other than immediate sensory feedback to arise. So it's interesting when you try to do a balancing kind of thing, right? Whether it's in yoga or any other kind of thing. So like if you're trying to do, for instance, tree pose, for instance, you will notice, if you pay attention, that you don't actually necessarily stay completely still. Have you noticed that? Just in the same way as this man was walking the tightrope, there were some micro adjustments going on there, right? Probably in terms of, you know, what he was doing with his body very subtly, but also in terms of the use of this pole. So he managed to stay in the middle, there in the middleness of it all, but it wasn't through rigidity. Right? He wasn't saying to himself, I would imagine he was probably pretty completely void of thinking altogether, but he wasn't saying to himself, no, don't slip. Don't slip. Uh-oh, the wind's coming up now. Uh-oh. It's a long way down. Right? I'm guessing his mind was probably like completely quiet, and that the attention was completely connected to the bare experience, right? The bare sensory feedback that he was receiving physically, and he was so experienced in making these micro adjustments that they were happening spontaneously without him having to think about it. He wasn't going, oh, I better use the pole like that. I better do that one. Oh, no, too much. Oh, I better do that. Right? He was just like in there. He was in the zone. He was with the thing. He and the thing were one. There wasn't a duality there. So I said, you know, one image of equanimity is the rock that's unmoving and is not affected by anything that's happening. Another image or version of equanimity is this extreme close contact with immediate experience that has a kind of flexibility in it, in that the attention easily recognizes, without resistance or overlay of other things, what is being known, and spontaneously is able to make adjustments to remain in balance in relationship to what's happening. So I know we have somebody here who was a sailor in real life, so they'll have to pardon me my use of this image. But let's take a sailor. I mean, like somebody, like sailboat sailor. What's the difference between a good sailor and a bad one? Well, you know, part of that would have to be that one is skillfully responsive to conditions and the other one lacks receptivity and an appropriate response, right? You know how sailing works. It's not like a railroad, right? It's not like you just like point the boat in the direction you want to go. There's a lot of tacking and, you know, changing the setting of sails. And you ever watch some of these yacht races? No, they're not that class of people, are you? Well, okay, so you see them on TV, okay? I think maybe I saw a few of those once when I was visiting Nantucket for a few days. But anyway, so in these yacht races, you'll see people changing the sails and they'll be, you know, like cranking frantically, and they'll be, you know, running up to one part of the boat and clipping something on or unclipping something and taking it down. And, you know, the idea is maximum speed because it is a race. But, you know, they're trying to hold a line that they think will make them be the fastest. And you'll see these pictures of the yacht going like this, right? Like this. It's like almost underwater in terms of, I'll say the side rail. I'm sure that's not what it's called, but it's almost underwater. And then the people who are on the racing vessel, they're on the other side. They're on the high side, and they're like hanging over the side trying to be a counterweight, right? So they can hold that angle without the whole thing tipping over. So again, you know, spontaneous, wise reaction to keep in balance with the totality of what's happening. That's an image that comes to my mind when I think of equanimity or upekkha. So it's not like being a fixity and not being receptive in a certain kind of way. It's the mind has learned to be so receptive. The energy of the mind has gone into knowing immediate experience without there being enough distraction in the system to cause the attention to jump out of the mindfulness groove. So let me talk about upekkha as it shows up in our vipassana practice. So I've said before that it's wisdom that actually liberates the mind, right? Coming to understand how things are, illumination of the real nature of things leads to the mind's purification and its liberation. So how do we learn about the real nature of things as they are? Well, the Vipassana practice that you're doing here is intended to introduce you to that in your own individual laboratory where you pay attention, where you attend moment to moment to what you're knowing. And you'll see, you know, the mind, mindfulness is there, and then, to use my image again, you'll jump out of the attentional thread, right? Get lost in hindrance, get lost in thought. At a certain point you come back, you know, find the attentional place of attention and the object of attention. So as we've gradually increased the the instructions to attend to more and more things. One of the things that we've introduced is this teaching on attending to Vedana, feeling tone. Now, the Buddha has a very important and rather deep teaching called the teaching on dependent origination. Has anybody heard of that teaching? Some folks have. Okay, so I'll give you the simplified version of it and how it pertains to this quality of Vedana that we're encouraging you to include in your practice now when it's visible. So the understanding is, with every moment of sense contact, Vedana arises. So we're always having this experience of pleasantness and unpleasantness and neutrality, neither pleasant nor unpleasant, arising. Sometimes it can be a very strong experience and it's visible to us and it might be the main thing we notice. It's right there on top. Other times, it's not. But the Buddha says that in the absence of mindfulness and wisdom, we are organically set up so that if we have an experience of pleasantness, the mind will go into craving. It'll go into wanting it, holding on to it. And very often the experience of pleasantness that we might have might be just hardly even aware of the pleasantness, but all of a sudden we might recognize, oh, craving is here, like wanting is happening, you know, arising out of a thought maybe, or a sensory experience that we're having, or a memory, or whatever. Oh, craving is here. Sense contact, pleasantness, craving arises in the absence of mindfulness. And likewise, sense contact, unpleasant Vedana, in the absence of mindfulness, goes into aversion. Like, get that away from me. I don't like that. Right? So the Buddha says that the path to freedom is about learning to recognize how discretionary human suffering is created and how it can be unbound. And he points to this teaching in particular about how the mind relates to Vedana and says, you really want to look very carefully here and train the mind to recognize Vedana with mindfulness in a way that you're connecting with this. You're not pushing it away. You're not denying anything. You're not making pleasant a problem. You're not making unpleasant, you know, a tragedy. You're just recognizing what's happening, what's there now in a very matter-of-fact way. And if the mind learns how to do that, then it doesn't take the next step into suffering. It doesn't necessarily go into craving. It doesn't necessarily go into aversion. It doesn't necessarily go into disconnect or delusion or dissociation with the mid-range of experience, the neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So how do you train the mind to keep its seat? It has to do with the cultivation of mindfulness, hearing the teachings on Vedana, learning to recognize the arising of Vedana, and learning to recognize that we don't need to be driven into hindrances, into states of suffering. If we can learn to keep our attentional focus close to what we're experiencing. So to get back to Philippe on the pole with on the guide wire with the pole, the way he could do that is he was close in. He was very connected to his immediate experience. And we're training the mind to be connected and close in with its immediate experience. There's a teaching on the first and second arrow. Have people heard that teaching? It's not about Robin Hood. But, so this is a teaching where he talks about how unwise attention to what we're experiencing really doubles down on whatever dukkha there may be. So say we're having painful emotional or physical experiences, or we've had an experience of loss and now that's present in our psyche. You know, if the mind reacts to that in a way that is without a Dharma context, you know, like through a hindrance, like striking out at the experience or trying to hold on to the experience, the Buddha says, well, you get double trouble. Not only don't you change the immediate subjective experience that you're having, but now you've got the arising of a bunch of hindrances in the mind on top of it. So you're suffering twice. That's the second arrow. Not only do you have knee pain, but now you have anger that there's knee pain, and now you're angry at yourself because you're the kind of person that gets angry at meditation retreats. And now you're sad because you think about going home and you're going to tell people that, you know, you're bad at it, and now you feel bad about being sad because you're going to have to tell them, right? Isn't this how it all unfolds? It all comes because your knee hurts. So that's an example of the kind of ride that we go on. What if the mind experience was knee pain, unpleasant, not liking, wanting to get rid of? Oh, self-compassion. Oh, unpleasant. Difficult. Oh, sensations. Unpleasant. Can you see that that's a very different thing, right? You're completely connected with the immediate experience. You're much more closely connected to the actual facts of the immediate experience than in the previous scenario. The mind is realistic about what it's experiencing, but it isn't borrowing trouble. Right? It isn't thrown off the horse of mindfulness by the unpleasantness of the experience. If you look at the seven factors of awakening, this is a teaching that was briefly mentioned, and I'll only briefly mention it as well, but this is a teaching that was briefly mentioned in the hall. And the idea is that by recognizing mindfulness and practicing with it, deploying it skillfully, if you want to put it that way, from that, there then opens up a number of other specific, wholesome and onward leading qualities of the mind that both flow from wisdom and strengthen it and in a certain kind of way complete it. So mindfulness is first. Without mindfulness, you can't do any of these practices. So mindfulness is first. Mindfulness leads to investigation. Mindfulness investigates. So when the teachers are, like in the practice meetings or things, if the teachers say to you, oh, what was that? What did you experience? So, you know, yogis come and talk about what's been happening. And a teacher might say, well, tell me about that. Right? So they're kind of curious to see how you describe your experience. In other words, what you're noticing about the experience that you're having. So from what you say about how you noted something, that gives a clue about how you're working with the experience, right? What you're recognizing about it as it's unfolding in real time. So mindfulness actually investigates experience when it's there, right? Is the breath long or short? When the mind recognized aversion was present, what happened next? What happened next? Oh, aversion, aversion. Unpleasant? That's how you get Dharma teachers asking you these stupid questions like, was it pleasant or unpleasant? I'm just... I remember having a woman once in a kind of a big retreat, and it was not really a silent retreat like this, but it was, you know, a mindfulness retreat. And I can remember she was talking about having tinnitus. And she said, I've got tinnitus. I said, what's that like? And she said, tinnitus. I said, well, what's it like? How do you experience it? She said, it's tinnitus. I said, is it unpleasant? And she said, it's tinnitus. I said, what's the mind's relationship to that? Do you want to get rid of it? She says, yeah. I said, and then she said, I see what you're doing. And she said, if somebody was here and they had lost a leg, would you just tell them to accept it? And I said, well, unless they could grow another one. It's like, but you see what I'm saying here? All right. So you got something, right? You got something going on. You got some experience present. Can you recognize what it is with interest and learn to attend to it with wisdom as it unfolds? So this is within the context of the meditation practice. So the investigation is bringing the mind to the experience with interest and seeing its specifics as it unfolds in time or as it's replaced by something else. Okay? So from this application of mind with investigation, the next thing that arises is interest, rapt interest, rapture, rapt interest. So this is a surprising thing that some of you may have found in the walking practice, that something that was as dull as watching paint dry, as you continued with it, if you really committed attention to it, you may have found to your great surprise that all of a sudden The sensations on the bottom of your feet, well, they're kind of interesting, actually. Like the mind is kind of like liking this a little bit, like feeling the feet for 45 minutes. Wow. Oh, I never knew it was so interesting. Things become interesting when you are interested. Okay, rapture arises and a kind of happiness in the practice. From that, there arises calm or tranquility. Calm. The mind starts to actually find some pleasant experiences that could be more subtle than the kind of things we usually think of as being the most pleasant. Ah, actually, the mind is not so reactive right now to what it's experiencing. It's kind of like moving a little bit more into the mid-range, you know, the pendulum of being for something and being against something and being disconnected from something. That seems to be slowing down. There's actually some tranquility and maybe some growing ease in the body and mind. And from that, the arising of concentration, where the mind actually becomes quite unified in what it's knowing. And in that process attracts many other wholesome qualities of mind to come to the forefront. So now, wise concentration, the side effect of that is the hindrances, at least temporarily, are at bay. They're largely closed out. They're not arising in the same kind of way. So there's less of that experience of, you know, being mindful and then going on a trip and, you know, trying to haul it back in and try to be mindful again, and then you're on another trip and then you got to haul it back in, and, right? It's much more continuous, and attention is less distracted. And one is seeing things more clearly and more closely without the influence of the hindrances. So the last thing that opens in the practice is equanimity. And that's in part because with both mindfulness and concentration and these other wholesome factors of mind quickening, now the mind has lost a lot of resistance and insistence, and it's getting much more matter-of-fact about just recognizing what's there, and a lot of the preferencing of certain kinds of things over others has fallen away. So now we're like Philippe, we're in close contact with what we're experiencing. There isn't the distraction field that keeps us from more continuously noticing and noting what's happening. So now we're starting to see the full range of vedana, for instance. We can see unpleasant things arise. The mind is very matter-of-fact, unpleasant, unpleasant. The mind sees pleasant things arise. The mind is very matter-of-fact. Oh, pleasant, pleasant. Oh, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. In other words, it starts bringing the same kind of fullness of attention to anything that's there. So when that is the case, the mind is further supercharged in terms of being able to accurately see what is present. See it at increasing depths, more and more closely. And of course, one of the things that one does see is impermanence. The change of objects and the change within objects. There's this experience here, now there's this experience here, now there's this experience here, and now there's this experience, but now it's changing, now it's becoming this other thing. Oh, now it passes away. Oh, now something else is here. oh, it passes away, now there's something else here, right? The mind gets much more attuned to the stream of things arising and passing away, coming and going. So that's an important seeing. And this whole practice in a certain kind of way, because it is a wisdom practice, is tuned and turned towards establishing this capacity to see this for yourself. And this is usually the first of the three universal characteristics that you would notice. Impermanence. Impermanence. You start to realize, wow, it's all impermanent. It's all impermanent. So do you think deep experiential experience of the truth of impermanence would somewhat restructure the mind's tendency towards clinging? Yeah, it would, because you see, it's like not pertinent. It's still a mind habit, but you see, it's like, what's the point? It's not like you can keep it from happening. It's there, it's happening. It's happening. I'm talking about things in real time now. Oh. Change being known, impermanence being known. Unpleasantness being known, pleasantness being known. So the mind gets, in this seventh factor of awakening, equanimity, the mind is very steady. It's present with everything. Everything is being registered exactly as it is. So this is how wisdom illuminates the real nature of things through the purification of mind that leads to liberation. Liberation from what? Liberation from delusion, from our wrong ideas about how things work. And just to say a last thing about equanimity. You've been doing the Brahmaviharas, right? You've been working with metta. Now consider the structure of the metta practice for a moment. So you know it starts where it's organically easiest, right? That's the usual instruction. You start with, you know, a benefactor or self, or, I don't know, an image of a kitten or something. And the idea is, just in the same way that Vipassana practice opens up with progressive instruction, so the metta practice has progressive instruction. You can see that, right? You gradually add a different kind of being, and, you know, and then you add one that's sort of neutral, and then you add a difficult person. You can see with that, that equanimity is a huge support in being able to do that practice in places where the mind is resistant, where it's not necessarily as organic, right? Because if the mind is less reactive, for instance, to the thought of the difficult person, in other words, even if the thought of the difficult person is still unpleasant, if the mind doesn't go into aversion there, then the mind can work with that person a lot more easily, right? Because it's the same thing that you see in the insight practice. Sense contact, vedana. If mindfulness and equanimity is present, the mind doesn't necessarily go into the, I'm not doing it to that guy. Or if the mind does, then you recognize that's what's happening. And just as metta practice is one of the Brahmaviharas, there's three others, right? The second practice of these heart practices is compassion, karuna. where the mind is turned towards a recognition of suffering and comes forward with goodwill which wishes to relieve it, right? The third of the Brahmavihara practices is something called mudita, which is empathetic joy, right? Happiness at the good fortune or well-being of another, right? This is where the mind kind of like gets on board the happiness train at the thought of somebody else being happy. It's like, you got that job, that's so great! It's so great! It's mudita. But then you might be surprised to know that the last of these is actually equanimity. So equanimity comes in as the last of these heart practices with a wisdom reminder. So if you look at what the phrases are for equanimity, it would be something like, may I accept the coming and going of things with grace and balance. Or may you accept the coming and going of things with grace and balance. Or in some cases, a skillful choice might be something like, I care about you, but I cannot make your choices for you. Right? Wisdom reflections. Wisdom reflections that help ground us in the truth that we don't completely or directly control the well-being of others very often, right? We may wish people to be happy. We may wish people to be safe. We may act in a way to promote that. But we don't govern that. Right? So can we be full-hearted? Can we cultivate metta, be filled with metta? Cultivate compassion, be filled with compassion? Cultivate mudita, be filled with mudita, and not get into an entangled or unwholesome or suffering kind of relationship in regard to these wishes for the well-being of another or ourself, right? In other words, can we develop and maintain some wisdom that can be seen in the presence of this quality of upekkha. Okay. So that's enough for tonight, but yeah. Mindfulness, the balance pole. That's mindfulness. Wise attention, continuous mindfulness. That's what brings the mind into balance and keeps it there. Okay. May the practice that we've done here together by offering and hearing the Dhamma be a cause and condition for the happiness, well-being, and liberation of ourselves and all beings.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.